So tonight's talk, it's a talk that every time I give it, I say, look, this is an advanced talk. It may not make sense to you. If it doesn't make sense, don't sweat it, all right? It's an advanced talk. And if it doesn't make sense, don't worry about it, okay? I'm just going to put it out there. Hopefully you'll be able to follow some of it, and some of it will be useful. Maybe you can follow it all, but yeah. We'll see where it goes. Okay. So tonight I want to look at a discourse on dependent origination that occurs in the Samyutta Nikaya in Book 12, which is the book on dependent origination, some close to 100 suttas on dependent origination. Some of the suttas are apparently quite early, and some are quite late, and most we can't tell. But this is one of the suttas that the scholars think is probably fairly early. It's Samyutta 12:15, the Kacchanagota Sutta. Thus have I heard, once the Buddha was living at Savatthi. Then the venerable Kacchanagota approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, and sat down at one side, and said to him, Venerable Sir, it is said, right view, right view. In what way, Venerable Sir, is there right view? Okay, so the first thing to notice is the sutta is given to the venerable Kacchanagota. It's not given to some monk or Kacchanagota. He's the venerable Kacchanagota. If he's called venerable, then he probably has been a monk for a while, and this is probably going to be an advanced teaching. And I would say that this is the most profound sutta, in my opinion, in the whole canon. So yeah, an advanced teaching. So Kacchana wants to know about right view. This world, Kacchana, for the most part, depends upon a duality, upon the notion of existence and the notion of non-existence. Now, existence here is not bhava, which sometimes gets translated as existence. I'm translating it as becoming. Existence is, it is or it is not. Sometimes you see the sutta translated, depends upon the concept of it is and the concept of it is not. But for one who sees the origin of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of non-existence in regard to the world. And for one who sees the cessation of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there's no notion of existence in regard to the world. So if you pay attention to the arising and passing of phenomena, when you see phenomena arise, you don't think in terms of non-existence. You're seeing phenomena arising. And when you see phenomena ceasing, you don't think in terms of existence. This world, Kacchana, for the most part, is shackled by engagement, clinging, and adherence, views and opinions. But one with right view does not become engaged and cling through that engagement and clinging, mental standpoint, inherence, underlying tendency. One with right view does not take a stand about my atta, myself, my soul. Well, that's kind of interesting. The Buddha, at one point, was asked by the wanderer Vajragota, Venerable Sir, once and for all, is there a self? Is there an atta? Is there a soul? And the Buddha remained silent. Venerable Sir, is there not an atta, not a self, not a soul? Again, the Buddha remained silent. Vajragota got up and left. After he left, Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, turned to the Buddha and said, Why didn't you answer the wanderer Vajragota? If I had answered that there was a self, he would have fallen into the mistake of eternalism. Is that consistent with my teaching? No, venerable sir. If I had said there was no self, he would have fallen into the mistake of annihilationism. Better not to say anything so he doesn't get any more confused than he is already. So the Buddha wouldn't say whether there is a self or not a self. This was actually quite wise, because Vajragupta keeps showing up and keeps coming and asking questions. And the Buddha is so brilliant with his answers that eventually Vajragupta becomes a monk, and eventually he becomes fully awakened. So the Buddha knew what he was doing. But here, the Buddha is saying, one with right view does not take a stand about my atta. Doesn't say there is a soul, doesn't say there isn't a soul. One with right view has no perplexity or doubt that what arises is only dukkha arising. What ceases is only dukkha ceasing. Now that always puzzled me for a long time. I mean, that ice cream that arose, that was not dukkha. Why is this being called dukkha? One with right view. One with right view has no perplexity or doubt that what arises is only dukkha arising. What ceases is only dukkha ceasing. Okay. It puzzled me until I realized that dukkha doesn't mean suffering, doesn't mean unsatisfactoriness, doesn't mean unpleasantness, doesn't mean bummer, although those translations are getting better as we go through the list, but at its most basic level means not a source of lasting satisfaction. So let's reread this again. He has no perplexity or doubt that what arises is only something that is not a source of lasting satisfaction that's arising. And what ceases is only something that's not a source of lasting satisfaction that's ceasing. So by translating dukkha that way and getting really to the broadest meaning that it has, yeah, okay, the ice cream was not a source of lasting satisfaction. I'd like some more right now. I mean, it only worked for a little while. When one sees that it's all dukkha, one's knowledge about this is independent of others. In other words, one has experienced it for oneself. One doesn't need a teacher to explain what's going on. It is in this way, Katyayana, that there is right view. All exists, Katyayana. This is one extreme. All does not exist. This is the second extreme. Without veering towards either of these extremes, a Tathagata teaches the Dhamma via the middle, with this as necessary condition that arises, with the ceasing of this necessary condition that does not arise. Actually, what I just told you is only found in the Chinese Agama version, right? The Pali version says, with ignorance as condition, sankharas come to be. With sankharas as condition, consciousness. It goes right on up the line. Such is the origin of this whole mass of dukkha. But with the remainderless fading away and cessation of ignorance comes the cessation of sankharas. With the cessation of sankharas, the cessation of consciousness, all the way up to line. Such is the cessation of the whole mass of dukkha. So the 12 links are given in the forward arising order and then the forward ceasing order, which when I first read this sutta was like, huh? What does that have to do with what came before? And I really appreciated what this sutta is saying. It's really quite profound, but what's going on here? And then I began to think that, oh, somebody stepped on what the Buddha actually said. The Buddha said, Kachyana, everything exists is one extreme. Nothing exists is the other extreme. Without veering towards either of these extremes, a Tathagata teaches the Dhamma via the middle. Paticca-samuppada, dependent origination. This, that conditionality, paticca-samuppada, which we find as a phrase in multiple places, that makes a whole lot more sense. And so I just figured that somebody decided, hey, this will sound a lot cooler if we chant the 12 links right here. Because there are a bunch of suttas in here that end with the 12 links in the forward arising and forward ceasing order. And some of them, it makes no sense. But I figured I was sort of on my own making this assumption until I was reading G.C. Pandey's book, Studies in the Origin of Buddhism, where he points out exactly the same thing and points to a bunch of other suttas where he says, nah, they stepped on what was really there. And then someone sent me the Chinese Agama version, which has the this-that conditionality before the 12 links. So I think what we had originally was everything exists, it's one extreme. Nothing exists is the other extreme. Without veering towards either of these extremes, a Tathagata teaches the Dhamma via the middle. With this as necessary condition, that arises. When this necessary condition does not arise, that does not arise. Then somebody appended the 12 links, and then somebody else chopped out the actual ending of the sutta. But it's very clear what the Buddha is saying is, don't think in terms of existence. Don't think in terms of non-existence. See that there's nothing but streams of dependently originating phenomena interacting. That's all there is. So, when Sati, the son of the fisherman, thinks his consciousness transmigrates, he's thinking in terms of existence. He has an atta, his consciousness, that exists and will exist into the next birth. When the bridge between the two discourses in last night's sutta is inserted, and there's the Gandhava, that's thinking in terms of existence. There has to be something existing in order to make conception happen. It's not just enough to realize that, no, the union of a sperm and egg is all that it takes for conception to happen. But it doesn't always happen with every union of mother and father and with every time the mother is in season, as it so nicely puts it. Okay, it just happens some of the time. And you don't have to postulate the existence of a Gandhava. When you're postulating the existence, as opposed to seeing streams of dependently originating phenomena interacting, you're missing the bigger picture. So this sutta has quite a lot to say to us, all right? The notions of existence and non-existence is a duality, and most everybody's trying to think, is it real? Does free will exist or not exist? That was the question, right? And the Buddha's going, it's just a concept. There's dependently originated phenomena. That's all happening. That's all that's happening. And the same with determinism. Again, it's just a concept. In fact, if you start looking around, a tree is just a concept. We carve the tree out of the forest. We carve the forest out of the ecosystem. We're taking something that's much larger and picking out a piece of it and saying, that's it. In fact, anything that we separate out from the whole of the universe is thinking that it exists and is making a thing out of it when it's just a concept. This is trees. This is sunlight and minerals and gravity and birds living in it, and poop from the birds, and all this stuff They got transformed into a table that someday will become firewood. And so if you're isolating it down into a table or a bus shelter for a leprechaun, depending on what you want to do, you've missed the bigger picture. And every time we conceive of something as existing as apart from the rest of the universe, we're missing the bigger picture. Notice that things arise and pass away. And the whole idea of something existing or not existing is missing the arising and passing away, the streams of dependently originated phenomena interacting and then ceasing to interact. This world, for the most part, is shackled by engagement, clinging, and adherence, views and opinions. Our views really do color how we see the world. It really keeps us trapped. And the Buddha says that one with right view does not become engaged and cling through that engagement and clinging mental standpoint and adherence underlying tendency. Keep an open mind. And the first night when I talked about right view, right, one aspect of right view is not getting entangled in views. It's about having an open mind. One with right view does not take a stand about my atta. Now that's really quite profound. Sometimes the Buddha talked in terms of selves. You should do the Brahma-Vihara practices, all four of them, to all as to oneself. So you're conceiving of yourself and all these other selves. When the Buddha is talking about the five aggregates and saying, form is not self, Vedana is not self, perception is not self, mental activities are not self, consciousness is not self, he's talking in terms of not self. And at other times, he's saying there's neither a self nor not, right here. Don't take a stand about a self. This is the deepest level. All that arises and ceases is just something that can't give you lasting satisfaction. This can help you escape from dukkha, the suffering part of dukkha, right? Something that arises, it might be really nice. It might give you some pleasant experiences. The Buddha doesn't deny that. In talking about the aggregates, he says, the gratification is the joy that arises from any of these aggregates. The danger is that they can't provide lasting satisfaction because they're impermanent. And the escape is basically seeing that they can't provide lasting satisfaction, not doing the craving and clinging. So if you see that what's arising can't provide lasting satisfaction, you can enjoy it while it's there and not get freaked out when it goes away. When something that's there that you've been, well, spending a lot of quality time with, whether it be a thing or a person or whatever, and it goes away, can you remember, oh yeah, nothing's going to give me lasting satisfaction. I appreciate the fact that I got all of the goodies from whatever this was before it went away. It is in this way that there is right view. And then the middle way here is described as the path between the two extremes of everything exists and nothing exists. And the middle way path between the two extremes is to look at the world in terms of dependently originated phenomena. Now the person that turned me on to this sutta is a fella by the name of Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna lived in the 2nd century AD. He was born into a Brahmin family in South India, and when he was young, he excelled at the Brahminical teachings, but he had a sensuous side that was not fulfilled. He and three friends learned from a magician how to make themselves invisible, and they went sneaking into the king's palace, into the harem quarters, where they enjoyed themselves with the ladies. When the king found out about this, he stationed soldiers behind the curtains in the harem quarters and told them to strike above the footprints in the carpets. All three of Nagarjuna's friends were killed. Nagarjuna managed to avoid death only by standing next to the king. He managed to escape from the palace and fled to the hills. He had discovered that craving causes dukkha. He began practicing the Buddha's teachings. It is said in 3 months he had mastered all of the early teachings. And at that point he encountered an old monk in the Mahayana tradition. At that time, the Mahayana tradition was a newly emerging system of thought, basically saying that the older non-Mahayana, which we think of as the Theravada, had lost its way, and that the Mahayana was basically saying, no, you guys hanging out in the woods all the time aren't being compassionate, not caring for the world. And so now there was a new emphasis on compassion in the Mahayana tradition. Nagarjuna was enough inspired by this view of the world that he left his mountain hideaway and traveled throughout India seeking other Mahayana teachings. He was very skilled in debate and took on all comers and defeated them all, both Buddhist and non-Buddhist. He eventually had followers and rules for his followers to live by. At one point, he said, I have no teacher. At that point, some Nagas, some mythical sea serpents, had compassion for Nagarjuna, and they took him to the bed of a lake where the Prajnaparamita Sutras had been stored. The Prajnaparamita Sutras are a series of inspirational dialogues between the Buddha and some of his disciples and some of the bodhisattvas. You might be familiar with some of them, with the Diamond Cutter Sutra and the Heart Sutra. These are from the Prajnaparamita collection. These sutras had been given when the Buddha was alive, but they were too esoteric for the people alive at that time. And they had been entrusted to the Nagas to preserve until humanity developed enough so that they could be understood. And now the Nagas felt the time was ripe, and they gave the sutras to Nagarjuna to bring back to the human realm. He brought them back and wrote commentaries to them. And one of the commentaries is the Mulamayamaka Karika, the fundamental verses on the middle way. At one point, a king arranged for a contest of magic between Nagarjuna and a Brahmin scholar. The Brahmin scholar created a lake and a lotus throne in the middle of the lake and seated himself on the lotus throne and mocked Nagarjuna for being stranded on dry land. Nagarjuna conjured up a white elephant that waded into the lake, grabbed the Brahmin scholar, and threw him back on dry land. The Brahmin scholar admitted defeat, but wished that Nagarjuna was dead. Nagarjuna locked himself in his room. The next day, a worried disciple broke down the door. A cicada flew out. The room was empty. At least that's the story we get. All right. What we know for sure is somebody wrote the Mulamayamaka Karika, the fundamental verses on the middle way. It's 27 chapters of what appear to be debate notes. It's not a very highly polished treatise. It's difficult reading. But it's the earliest and probably still the most brilliant discussion of emptiness. You might have heard of the Mahayana concept of emptiness. Emptiness doesn't mean that things don't exist. It means they are empty of inherent existence. The Buddha said, don't think in terms of existence. Right? And emptiness is saying that, well, things arise from causes and conditions. There's no essence to them. If something has an essence, then it can't really change. Because if it changed, then it would be different from its essence. And so Nagarjuna is pointing out the flaws in conceiving of something that has an essence. Now, this attack is against the Abhidhammist from the Savastivadin lineage. The Savastivadins became the strongest Buddhist sect that was non-Mahayana. And their Abhidhamma says that things do have inherent existence, including the past, the present, and the future. Okay, so the past is real. I guess they were trying to pave the way for some of the world's greatest science fiction. All right? But anyhow, Nagarjuna goes, no, man, it's all empty. So what I want to do is read you a few of these chapters, which are mostly quite short, from Stephen Batchelor's translation of the Maloyamaka Karika. His translation is called Verses from the Center. And this is a chapter entitled Walking. I do not walk between the step already taken and the one I'm yet to take, which both are motionless. Is walking not the motion between one step and the next? What moves between them? Could I not move as I walk? If I move when I walk, there would be two motions, one moving me and one moving my feet. Two of us stroll by. There is no walking without walkers, and no walkers without walking. Can I say that walkers walk? Could I say they don't? Walking does not start in steps taken or to come, or in the act itself. Where does it begin? Before I raise a foot, is there motion, a step taken or to come, whence walking could begin? What has gone? What moves? What is to come? Can I speak of walkers when neither walking, steps taken, nor to come, ever end? Were walking and walker one, I would be unable to tell them apart. Were they different, there would be walkers who do not walk. These moving feet reveal a walker, but did not start him on his way. There was no walker prior to departure. Who was going where? Were walking and walker one, I would be unable to tell them apart. Were they different, there would be walkers who do not walk. The concept of a walker depends upon walking, but the walker is not the same as walking. And walking depends on the concept of a walker. Right? They are interdependent concepts. They arise simultaneously, but they're just concepts. Right? There's no real walker, no essence of walking, and no real essence of walker. The two arise dependent on each other, and it's a concept that we're actually placing on top of this activity and the one doing the activity. Seeing. If my eyes cannot see themselves, how can they see something else? Were there no trace of something seen, how could I see it all? Neither seeing nor unseeing see. Seeing reveals a seer who is neither detached nor undetached from seeing. How could you see and what would you see in the absence of a seer? Just as a child is born from mother and father, so consciousness springs from eyes and colorful shapes. Without these eyes, how could I know consciousness, contact, vedana, craving, clinging, becoming, birth, aging, and death? Seers seeing sights explain hearers hearing sounds, smellers smelling smells, tasters tasting taste, touchers touching textures, thinkers thinking thoughts. So again, the act of seeing requires a seer, and to have a seer, you have to have the act of seeing. Seeing reveals a seer who is neither detached nor undetached from seeing. How could you see and what would you see in the absence of a seer? Like walking, these two are very interdependent. Body. I have no body apart from the parts which form it. I know no parts apart from a body. A body with no parts would be unformed. A part of my body apart from my body would be absurd. Were the body here or not, it would need no parts. If the body had an essence, it wouldn't be dependent on its parts. Partless bodies are pointless. Do not get stuck in the body. I cannot say my body is like its parts. I cannot say it's something else. Vedana, perceptions, drives, minds, things are like this body in every way. Conflict with emptiness is no conflict. Objections to emptiness, no objections. I cannot say my body is like my parts. I cannot say it's something else. So you go to get your hair cut and you walk in and, you know, this is part of who you are, right? And then they cut your hair and you look on the floor. No, no, I'm laying on the floor. Well, no. When did it stop being a part of you? Well, as the scissors came through, right? But you weren't upset about it because, well, there was no discomfort, right? And then, yeah, there's part of you on the floor and they sweep it up and throw it away. Or you cut your fingernails, right? I mean, right now, yeah, you don't want this thing being ripped off. But, you know, at some point you'll just cut it off and throw it away. Right? So the parts of our body are, well, it's me if it hurts, if I sort of try and remove it. Right? That's what makes it me. But when does it stop being your body? Right? I mean, if you lost your arm, then, no, it wouldn't be part of your body anymore, right? It'd just be a thing. So it's the attachment that makes it you, right? I had surgery on my shoulders. When I would come out of the anesthesia, they'd given me a local block in my arm, and there was this warm piece of meat hanging off of me. I had no feeling in it, no control over it. It was just warm piece of meat attached to me. It was very strange. Went to sleep, woke up the next morning, and I had an arm. Right? So we start connecting this stuff. It's only a warm piece of meat right now. But because it has signals going up to the rest of me, I'll put myself into it. This next one is entitled Self. Were mind and matter me, I would come and go like them. If I were something else, they would say nothing about me. What is mine when there is no me? Were self-centeredness eased, I would not think of me and mine. There would be no one there to think them. What is inside is me, what is outside is mine. When these thoughts end, compulsion stops, repetition ceases, freedom dawns. Fixation spawns thoughts that provoke compulsive acts. Emptiness stops fixations. Buddhas speak of self and also teach no self, and also say there's nothing which is either self or not. When things dissolve, there's nothing left to say. The unborn and unceasing are already free. The Buddha said it is real and it is unreal, and is both real and unreal, and is neither one nor the other. It is all at ease, unfixable by fixations, incommunicatable, inconceivable, indivisible. You are not the same as or different from conditions on which you depend. You are neither severed from nor forever fused with them. This is the deathless teaching of Buddhas who care for the world. When Buddhas don't appear and their followers are gone, the wisdom of awakening bursts forth by itself. That might be worth reading again. Were mind and matter me, I would come and go like them. So you change out all your cells every 7 years. Does that mean you're a different person every 7 years? You change your mind more frequently than that. Every time you change your mind, are you a different person? But if I were something else, they would say nothing about me. What is mine when there is no me? The whole idea of clinging to something just isn't there if you're not conceiving of a me. Were self-centeredness eased, I would not think of me and mine. There would be no one there to think them. This is what the Buddha is talking about when he talks about uprooting conceit. Remember in the 10 fetters that bind us to the wheel of samsara, at full awakening, one of the fetters that's uprooted is conceit, the conceiving of a self. And so self-centeredness is then eased, and there's nobody to think of me and mine. What is inside is me, what is outside is mine. When these thoughts end, compulsion stops, repetition ceases, freedom dawns. This is how we're dividing up the world, subject and object. I am the subject, and this is the object. Fixations spawn thoughts that provoke compulsive acts. Emptiness stops fixations. Fixations is Stephen Batchelor's translation of papancha, mental proliferation. So mental proliferation spawns thoughts that provoke compulsive acts. Emptiness stops mental proliferation. Papancha is a great word. It's a really brilliant teaching because, yeah, that's what we're doing a lot, is just getting caught up in all these thoughts that we think them, so must be real. This is a story about a man whose wife asked him to go to the market and buy some potatoes. Yes, dear. So he gets up, gets ready to go. Just as he goes out the door, she says to him, "And oh, be sure and get a good price." "Yes, dear." So he starts walking towards the market, and he's thinking, "Yeah, she probably wants me to get good potatoes, too. It's easy to get bad potatoes for a good price, but to get good potatoes, it's going to be a bad price. You got to watch out for these potato sellers. They'll put good potatoes on top, and then they'll put bad potatoes at the bottom. Sometimes they'll put in a rotten potato. Oh, I hate the smell of rotten potatoes." At that moment, he walks up to the potato seller and says to him, "You can keep your rotten potatoes," and walks away. Okay? This is papancha. Right? We just start thinking stuff up and get carried away with it. Papancha spawns thoughts that provoke compulsive acts. Emptiness stops papancha. Buddhists speak of self and also teach no self, and also say there's nothing which is either self or not. So this is what I just mentioned. Brahmavihara practice, self. Looking at the five aggregates, not self. Kacchanagota Sutta, one who has right view does not take a stand about myself. When things dissolve, there's nothing left to say. The unborn and unceasing are already free. We think in terms of things existing. When you can get past things existing, when the thinginess dissolves, not because things don't exist, you just dissolve the thinginess. There's nothing left to say. The unborn and unceasing are already free. When you're not conceiving of something, it doesn't have a beginning or an end. You stop thingifying the world, and it's just the world unfolding. Nothing but streams of dependently originated phenomena interacting. The Buddha said it is real and it is unreal, and it's both real and unreal, and it's neither one nor the other. The Buddha spoke to people at the level he thought they could understand. It is all at ease, unfixable by fixations. It's all at ease. None of your mental proliferation is ever going to get the concepts right. It's just as it is. It's incommunicatable, inconceivable, and indivisible. It's a holistic universe out there. Every time you conceive of a piece of it, you're missing the bigger picture. You can't communicate the holistic universe. It's too big for our little pea brains to take in, let alone speak accurately about. So it's incommunicatable, inconceivable, indivisible. But it's at ease. You are not the same as or different from conditions on which you depend. You are neither severed from nor forever fused with them. This is the deathless teaching of Buddhas who care for the world. This may be the most brilliant verse I've ever read in all of Buddhism. This is the origin of my phrase, streams of dependently originated phenomena interacting. You are not the same as or different from the conditions on which you depend. You're just the end result of a bunch of streams of dependently originated phenomena interacting. You're not those streams of dependent originating phenomena, and you're not different from those streams of dependently originated phenomena. You are neither severed from them nor forever fused with them. Your high school is going to have a permanent impact on you, but that's not what you are. You're not severed from it, nor are you fused with it. You're not still stuck back in high school. This is the deathless teaching of Buddhas who care for the world. When Buddhas don't appear and their followers are gone, the wisdom of awakening bursts forth by itself. The truth is out there. You don't have to have a Buddha or the follower of a Buddha to point this out to you. But most of us aren't smart enough to figure it out on our own. But it's there. We just need some help in seeing it. Somebody has to say, pull the lid off the box and look inside. We've been turning the box over and looking at the outside of it. Okay, so when Buddhas don't appear and their followers are gone, the wisdom of awakening, the truth of nothing but streams of dependently originated phenomena interacting is out there. It bursts forth by itself. One more.
What is the name of that one?
Self. This one is entitled Awakening, though usually it's entitled The Four Noble Truths. It starts with a complaint by an opponent. This opponent thinks that Nagarjuna is teaching wrong doctrine. And the opponent says, if everything is empty, there would be no rising and passing. Ennobling truths would not exist. There would be no understanding. Letting go, cultivating, realizing, without tasting the fruits of practice, there would be no community, no sangha. With no truths, no dharma either. With no sangha and dharma, how could you awaken? Talk of emptiness maligns what is of value. Acts and fruits, good and evil, conventions fall apart. So this opponent has mistaken emptiness for nihilism. This is a common mistake, and you find people doing that today. Nagarjuna replies, not knowing emptiness, the need for it, or the point of it, you subvert it. The Dharma taught by Buddhas hinges on two truths, partial truths of the world and truths that are sublime. Without knowing how they differ, you cannot know the deep. Without relying on conventions, you cannot disclose the sublime. Without intuiting the sublime, you cannot experience freedom. Misperceiving emptiness injures the unintelligent, like mishandling a snake or miscasting a spell. The Buddha despaired of teaching the Dhamma, knowing it hard to intuit its steps. Your muddled conclusions do not affect emptiness. Your denial of emptiness does not affect me. When emptiness is possible, everything is possible. Were emptiness impossible, nothing would be possible. In projecting your faults onto me, you forget the horse you are riding. To see things existing by nature is to see them without causes or conditions, thus subverting causality, agent, tools and acts, starting, stopping, and ripening. Dependent origination is emptiness, which dependently configured is the middle way. Everything is dependently originated. Everything is empty. Were everything not empty, there would be no rising and passing. Ennobling truths would not exist. Without dependent origination, how could I suffer dukkha? This shifting dukkha has no nature of its own. If it did, how could it have a cause? Deny emptiness and you deny the origins of dukkha. If dukkha existed by nature, how would it ever cease? Absolute dukkha could never stop. How could you cultivate a path that existed by nature? How could it lead to the end of dukkha? A path on which you tread can have no essence of its own. If confusion existed by nature, I would always be confused. How could I know anything? Letting go and realizing, cultivation and fruition could never happen. Who could attain absolute goals that by nature are unattainable? Since no one could reach them, there would be no sangha. With no truths, no dharma either. With no sangha or dharma, how could I awaken? I would not depend on awakening, nor awakening on me. A naturally unawakened person would never awaken, no matter how hard he practiced for its sake. He would never do good or evil. An unempty person would do nothing. He'd experience the fruits of good and evil without having done good or evil deeds. How can fruits of good and evil not be empty if they are experienced? To subvert emptiness and dependent origination is to subvert the conventions of the world. It engenders passivity. Acts without an author, authors who do not act. Beings would not be born or die. They would be frozen in time, alien to variety. If things were unempty, you could attain nothing. Dukkha would never end. You would never let go of compulsive acts. To see dependent origination is to see dukkha, its origin, cessation, and the path. This might be worth reading again also. The Dharma taught by Buddhas hinges on two truths, partial truths of the world and truths that are sublime. We usually say relative and absolute, which is actually a horrible translation. What Nagarjuna is saying here is what we call relatives are truths that don't fully reveal. It's true, this is my Kindle, and this is your phone, Okay, but it doesn't fully reveal what's going on. It doesn't point to the dependently originated nature of the Kindle and the phone. And truths that are sublime, truths that are beyond the usual way of looking at things. Without knowing how these two truths differ, you cannot know the deep. There are circumstances where you need to operate with the truths that don't fully reveal, like crossing the street. And there are circumstances when you need to operate with the sublime truths. Without relying on conventions, you cannot disclose the sublime. The sublime doesn't lend itself to speaking about it except by using the conventional truths, the relative truths. You have to point at the ultimate truth, just like you have to point at the moon. Don't make the mistake of confusing the finger for the moon. Without intuiting the sublime, you cannot experience freedom. The relative truths, the truths that don't fully reveal, are quite useful, but they don't reveal enough for freedom, for liberation. What you need to understand is the sublime truths, the ultimate truths. And those can only be pointed at, like the fingers pointing at the moon, using the conventional. And that's exactly what Nagarjuna is doing here, pointing at the ultimate truths, particularly the truth of emptiness. Misperceiving emptiness injures the unintelligent, like you, Mr. Opponent, like mishandling a snake or miscasting a spell. The Buddha despaired of teaching the Dharma, knowing it hard to intuit its depths. Some people have lots of dust in their eyes, like you, Mr. Opponent. Your muddled conclusions do not affect emptiness. Your denial of emptiness does not affect me. You could see where this guy would be really awesome in a debate. When emptiness is possible, everything is possible. Were emptiness impossible, nothing would be possible. If there was no emptiness, if everything had an essence, it wouldn't be able to change. And so nothing would be possible. Everything is just stuck. But because things are arising due to streams of dependently originated phenomena interacting, then things can change and things are possible. In projecting your faults onto me, you forget the horse you are riding. This is about an Indian man who had 24 horses. And one morning he mounted up on one of his horses and rode out to count them. 1, 2, 3, 20, 21, 22, 23. Oh no, someone's stolen one of my horses. He forgot to count the horse he was riding. To see things existing by nature is to see them without causes or conditions. Thus subverting causality, agent, tools, and acts, starting, stopping, and ripening. If things have essence, then they're just stuck being like that forever. They've always been like that. There's no cause. It's just like that. And now we have what most people say is the most important verse in the whole Mulamayamaka Karika. Dependent origination is emptiness, which dependently configured is the middle way. Everything is dependently originated. Everything is empty. So emptiness is the same as dependent origination. The two teachings are identical. Everything is dependently originated. Everything is empty. Now, this translation doesn't bring it out. It says dependent origination is emptiness, which contingently configured is the middle way. Better translations bring out that emptiness is also empty. It's just a concept, right? It's not an ultimate. It's a concept. It's another finger pointing at the truth to try and help us see what's going on. Nagarjuna also says, believers in emptiness are incurable, right? It's just a concept, but it's a really useful one. Were everything not empty, there would be no rising and passing. Ennobling truths would not exist. Without dependent origination, how could I suffer dukkha? This shifting dukkha has no nature of its own. It arises, and one of the necessary conditions, is craving. If it had a nature of its own, how could it have a cause? Deny emptiness and you deny the origin of dukkha. Remember, this opponent says that Nagarjuna is denying the Four Noble Truths, and because he's talking about emptiness. And Nagarjuna is pointing out that, no, if you don't have emptiness, you're the one that's denying it. If dukkha existed by nature, how would it ever cease? If there was an essence to the dukkha, it would always be dukkha. It'd always be there. It wouldn't go away. Absolute dukkha could never stop. How could you cultivate a path that existed by nature? How could it lead to the end of pain? A path on which you tread can have no essence of its own. So, have you walked on the paths in the woods here? What's the essence of that path? No woods there. Right? It's all about not being there. Interesting. If confusion existed by nature, I would always be confused. Right? If being unenlightened was your essence, you'd be stuck being unenlightened forever. How could I know anything? Letting go and realizing cultivation and fruition could never happen. Who can attain absolute goals that by nature are unattainable? If enlightenment, awakening, had a nature, and it doesn't include you, you're not going to get there. Since no one could reach them, there would be no Sangha. With no truths, no Dharma either. With no Sangha or Dharma, how could I awaken? I would not depend on awakening, nor awakening on me. A naturally unawakened person would never awaken, no matter how hard he practiced for its sake. If you're not awakened now, and that's your essence, you're stuck being not awakened forever. It doesn't matter what you do. You can't change your essence. The essence is the essential part of you that is unchanging, at least according to the Abhidhammas that were the opponents. One would never do good or evil. An unempty person would do nothing. He'd experience the fruits of good and evil without having done good or evil deeds. How can fruits of good and evil not be empty if they're experienced? All this stuff is dependently originated. To subvert emptiness and dependent origination is to subvert conventions of the world. It engenders passivity. Acts without an author, authors who do not act. Beings would not be born nor die. They would be frozen in time, alien to variety. If you ever get an essence, you better hope you're in a good mood, because you're stuck like that forever. If things were unempty, you could attain nothing. Dukkha would never end. You would never let go of compulsive acts. To see dependent origination is to see dukkha, its origin, cessation, and the path. The next one is entitled Nirvana. I'm not going to read it because we're running out of time, but I am going to read a little bit. Samsara is no different from Nirvana. Nirvana is no different than samsara. Samsara's horizons are Nirvana's. The two are exactly the same. So this is where the Mahayana concept of samsara and Nirvana being the same thing arises. People sometimes want to make Nirvana or Nibbana have ontological existence. It's a place. And if you get enlightened, then you go to Nirvana. Well, maybe not immediately, but when you die and you're enlightened, you don't come back, you go to Nirvana. And they're just converting it into a heaven. They've got their immortality project nailed, right? There's a problem with that. If Nirvana has ontological existence and it doesn't change, remember, the only thing that doesn't change is Nirvana. Right? It's the only thing free of dukkha, and it's the only thing that doesn't change. And if it's got ontological existence, and it doesn't include you right now, you're stuck on the outside because it ain't going to change to let you in. But if nirvana is a realization rather than a place or a thing, if it's a way of seeing the world without the craving and clinging, if it's a way of seeing the world without selfing, then it's just a realization. And what's realized doesn't change, but you can realize that. When you realize that, this is samsara, and this is nirvana. There's not a whit of difference between the two. If you look at it with the eyes of craving and clinging, it's samsara, and it produces dukkha. If you look at it with the eyes of a Buddha, there's no dukkha. You're free. Any questions?
Sorry, but can you spell the whole title of the thing that you rattled off?
THEWHOLETITLE OF THEING. Let's see if we go.
This is Stephen Batchelor's
Verses from the Center.
Okay, Verses from the Center.
Hang on.
I can spell that. But the whole other thing. I guess it doesn't matter.
Hang on, we'll get there.
Because it's this one that I'm going to read in English.
Here we go.
Okay.
MULAMADHYAMAKAKARIKA. You want it again?
Can I hear you say it?
MULAMAYAMAKAKARIKA.
Dependent origination in Morse.
What?
It's dependent origination in Morse.
Morse code. Okay. MULA. MADHYAM. AK. AKA. RIKA.
Is that one word?
Yeah.
It's a compound.
It's a compound. Mula, root. Madhyamaka, middle way. Karika, verses. Root, middle way, verses. Usually translated as the fundamental verses of the middle way. Anything else?
So who wrote the Mahayana Suttas?
Well, they will tell you that it was written by the Buddha. The early Mahayanist. Okay, the tradition of putting words in the Buddha's mouth is very old. I mean, we find that in the Theravadin Suttas, right? So when the Mahayanists came along and they had different ideas, oh, very simple, let's write a sutra and put the words in the Buddha's mouth. I've heard the scholars say that the most famous one, the Heart Sutra, was composed in China and then translated into Sanskrit and brought back to India. So, yeah, some Chinese guy wrote that. I don't know who wrote these other things. There's the Vimalakirti Sutra, which probably was written by a former Hinayana monk, a Theravadin monk, except he wasn't Theravadin, he was probably Savastivadin. Because you read it and you get a sense this guy knew the Theravada really well, but he had issues with it. So yeah, just a bunch of different Mahayanists wrote this stuff. That's what I would say. Just like, you know, the suttas that are put into the words of into the mouth of the Buddha in the Theravadin, it was a bunch of Theravadins did that.
How about right speech and all of that?
How about right speech and all of that? Well, The interesting thing when right speech is detailed, what it says is that if someone asks you, did you see and you saw, you have to say, yes, you saw. You don't lie and say you didn't see. And when they say, what did you see, then you need to say what you saw. Okay? So it's about telling the truth when you're asked. So I guess that's how they get around it.
Nobody asks.
Nobody asks.
By the way, first, yeah, I heard Sanki Rinpoche say that he thought that Nagarjuna and I had psychological problems. And he probably wouldn't like Dzogchen because he'd be scared. He'd just be petrified if there was something there.
Yeah, I think, well, the Mahayanas claim Nagarjuna is one of the founders of the Mahayana. But this work reads more like a commentary on the Kacchanagota Sutta. As I mentioned, Nagarjuna was who turned me on to the Kacchanagota Sutta because he mentions it by name in this particular work. So it was like, what is this sutta? And so I looked it up and I went, way cool, all right. So he also mentions an early Mahayana sutra as well. So he clearly had feet in both worlds. There's someone who did a translation of this and basically is saying that Nagarjuna is a Theravadin. I think that's pushing things too much. I think he was his own man. And he was saying basically to the Savastivadins, you guys got it screwed up. Here's the way it is. And he wasn't saying, and I'm a Mahayana. He just was claimed to be a Mahayana. Right. Yeah, exactly.
What's the problem?
The problem is,
how should I reply?
The problem is you may get away with correctly seeing breakfast is not a source of lasting satisfaction. But there may be other things that you're counting on being a source of lasting satisfaction. And when it turns out they aren't, you'll experience unpleasantness.
Like marriage.
Like marriage. Yeah. I mean, think about it. The best possible outcome for any relationship is one of you dies of old age.
Till death do us part.
Right.
In there.
So marriage is not going to be a source of lasting satisfaction. Right? It's sorry. So, but breakfast, yeah, it's okay. It's not a source of lasting satisfaction. But marriage, you sometimes want that to be a source of lasting satisfaction. Otherwise, you wouldn't have gotten into that.
If you die first.
What?
But if you die first.
Yeah, but the marriage is not a source of lasting satisfaction. The other person is going to find it unpleasant. Yeah.
It seems like there's also, I don't know if this is relevant to that issue, but there's people who don't have breakfast. I don't know if that's relevant somehow, yeah. But it seems like it.
Yeah, there are people who...
You got yours, but Dukkha doesn't... I don't know, maybe right. It's a whole other topic, isn't it?
Yeah. It's just to realize that, yeah, sometimes you're fine with something not being a source of lasting satisfaction. Truth is, yeah, the ice cream today, it was not a source of lasting satisfaction, but yeah, it was fine, no problem. Well, actually, maybe my sinus is worse, but okay. It's okay that it's gone, but there's other stuff, that if it were to disappear, I would be rather upset. So. Yeah, I'm counting on that thing being a source of lasting satisfaction.
Yeah, and the issue is when we're clinging, we get obsessed and then we forget what's around and we disconnect from the present moment. So.
Right. So. Once we get locked in, yeah, we're completely missing the bigger picture. Yeah.
May I ask you a question regarding the subject, the last day? Do your retreat ends at 9:30, or do you have any? We have any activities before 9:30 or between breakfast and 9:30?
The morning schedule will be identical up to and through breakfast, okay, except we'll break silence at breakfast, and then afterwards, if you have a job associated with breakfast, like washing the dishes, you'll do that job and you'll do your final chore.
And that's it.
That's it.
So if I need to leave earlier than 9:30, it's okay.
If you've gotten your final chore done.
Right, right.
Yeah, right. Tomorrow is Tuesday. Tomorrow is day two on the round of interviews. Yeah. Right.
In the relative world, there is
something that we call. Right. In the relative world, there are choice points, and we need to make wise choices, very definitely.
Yeah.
But the relative world view is a limited view, and we need to get the additional absolute view, but that doesn't negate anything in the relative world.
Okay, because we're trying to excuse something.
Right. Yeah. Right. You still got to make the right choices in the relative world. The relative world and the absolute world actually interpenetrate. Remember, it's not that they're separate worlds, it's separate viewpoints, separate perspectives. Yeah.
I'm a little bit confused. Just a little.
Okay, good.
So, with regard to that, from the relative perspective, there is free will.
Mm-hmm.
From a sublime absolute perspective, there is not free will. And nirvana and samsara are coextensive. Nirvana is an insight or a realization that transforms your understanding of the relative perspective or samsara.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, in doing that, it doesn't get rid of free will, does it?
The Buddha rose early one morning, took his robe and bowl, and went towards Savatthi to go on alms round. And then he thought, it's too early to go on alms round. Why don't I go to the single hall in Queen Malika's park? There are wanderers there who might be interesting to talk with. So he decided to do one thing and changed his mind and decided to do something else. Yeah, that's Digha Nikaya number 9. All right. And so, yeah, the Buddha still had free will on the relative level. And he's telling people on the relative level, hey, keep the precepts. You've got enough free will so that you can do that. It's just, if you take that perspective, you're not going to be able to gain freedom. You're going to need to take a deeper perspective. And from that deeper perspective, free will disappears, but so does the craver and clinger and the person who would be doing the freely willed things.
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering then, is it really that, from the absolute perspective, free will is sort of gotten rid of, or is it sort of liberated in a way so that you can walk down the street by the bakery and behave responsibly, and so on and so forth with
From the absolute perspective, the concept of free will is not useful. From the relative perspective, the concept of determinism is not useful. They are both concepts, even when they're useful and not useful. They're only concepts that we're trying to use to discuss what's going on. What's useful is to walk by the bakery and just keep on walking. Right? Whether you think you have free will or don't have free will to go into the bakery. Does that help?
Yeah, it helps.
Yeah, it's we take the concepts to be real. This is really a table. No, it's just some wood. Well, no, it's not even really wood. It's a piece of the universe. That's all there is. It's pieces of the universe we've separated out. We're pieces of the universe. It's like, this is the universe. The universe pokes up an eyeball, right? It's looking around, yeah. But it's a mobile sensing device on the surface of the universe, right? It's not fixed in one place. And the mobile sensing device has the ability to look down and go, me! And it thinks it's separate from the universe, but it's just a piece of the universe, just like the table's a piece of the universe. When we get the concept of me and mine at the relative level, sometimes that's quite useful. Because when I leave here, I'll put on my shoes, not your shoes. Right? But it's just pieces of the universe. And actually separating it out from the whole universe clouds what's going on. We actually need to always think of the whole universe, but our little pea brains can't ever do that.
Okay. I guess then what I'm wondering is, does this holistic view provide me, or any of us, with some new criterion by which we make better decisions?
Yeah.
Going forward.
Yeah. It removes the conceiving of a self. Having removed the conceiving of the self, there's no basis for self-action.
Okay.
Just like if you remove the conceiving of the edge of the world, it removes the basis for fear of falling off the edge of the world. That help?
That
okay.
So can you get that whole sutta before breakfast?
Do what?
Dīghanikāya 9.
Dīghanikāya number 9, the Potapada Sutta, the first half is all before breakfast.
Wow. It takes you a whole month to go through it.
It takes Ayakema 12 days to go through it. Yeah, but only the first half. The second half was a few days later.
Okay.
So it was only like 6 days worth before breakfast. Yeah, the Buddha packed it in. Okay, so short break and then metta.